Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play dude.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah. We are back. Time for another episode of the Toy Department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. I'm gonna go ahead and put the jinx on this episode and say,
what?
Say we could be looking at a short show today.
Sounds good to me.
Which means we definitely won't be, because I.
You're probably right.
One day we'll just do a whole show where I don't mention it, but I just have my like fingers crossed the whole time.
We'll see how that works.
We'll
out.
Get out of here on time.
My fingers are crossed right now for that eventuality.
We'll see. Or maybe I'll cross toes, something like that. Uh-huh. All right. We got a few things to cover today, including the Netflix movie Paddleton, the HBO movie OG. We're going to jump into some music with Gary Clark Jr. But let's start with the return of Better Things on FX. I think it's safe to say the shadow of Louis C.K. Hangs over the run-up to this season of FX. He was, you know, I think we talked about this a little bit last week, that he was a major creative force behind the development of the show and the writing of the show, mm-hmm. Particularly season one, maybe a little less so in season two, but certainly a co-writer on almost all of that season. And yep. then, you know, for obvious reasons, gone. So the question, you know, coming into this season, I guess, is sort of what, you know, what show remains, you know, does the tone of it change? Does the, you know, what can we expect from a Louis C.K. less season of this show? And I don't know about you, but I was, really delighted, by this first episode. I don't think the show was lost a step, and in some ways may be better than ever.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we have enough information to say better than ever, but it certainly feels like the same show and was just as heartfelt and funny and smart and awesome. I mean, it's an awesome
too.
Show.
You know what I mean? It's real. The show is real and surreal at the same time.
Yes, and really cool. I'm particularly aware of the tone and feeling around the show because I have spent the last week and a half leading up to it watching the first two seasons with my fiance, and it's a totally unique, you know, it's one of these things where I watch it and after I watch it I want to say it's the best show on television, and I don't know if that's true because I think things like Game of Thrones and you know, maybe a couple other bigger, more elaborate things probably deserve that title.
Yeah, I mean, look, it depends a little bit on what you value.
But that's exactly right. Yeah. This show is so good and so well done that it's hard to say anything on television is better than it. And the other thing I learned from watching it is, you know, there's only 20, including the premiere, 21 episodes now. And altogether, you know, that's something like 7 or 8 hours of television. So you can really hammer through it. And if you have not seen it, I would strongly recommend that you do. It is so good. And Pamela Adlon is a force. And all the kids are really quite wonderful. It's a great, great, great show.
Yeah, it's really kind of remarkable. You know, you mentioning 21 episodes. Like the depth at which we know the characters in this family now, you know, so a moment where, you know, the daughter's being dropped off at college and like sort of the night that they have and don't have together, like all of those feelings are really earned, I think, over the course of, you know, two seasons and change of this show, right? Where you're really, it's very easy to put yourself in her place. at that point. I think it's one of the best portrayals of like familial relationships on TV. Like, it so perfectly captures both the love and the just day-to-day frustration, you know, of being a part of the family unit in a way that is like lovely and moving and sentimental, but not cheesy,
right,
and totally real, you know?
No, you're right. It's clearly the best. I'm trying to think of other shows that do a good job of that, and they're not coming to mind, which I'm sure is more a reflection of my mind than the lack of their existence. But it's both a family drama and a comedy and this sort of beautiful feminist piece, and it's remarkable.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say about it other than it's just – It's done as well as anything on TV.
It's the kind of show I wish more people were watching.
Yeah.
And I know that, look, they have different ends, and a show like This Is Us, I think, is largely designed to be, you know, like apple cobbler, you know, for mm-hmm. people. Like, its sweetness is the design, you know? Right. But I do wish that everyone who watched that show had at least checked out better things, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. It's just a smarter, better version, right? I mean, and this is, we're not being totally ignorant about This Is Us. We watched it, and this show is just better.
Yeah, I didn't even mean that as a harangue against This Is Us.
That's no, I
just,
know. Yeah, I don't either. That's it was fine. I get it. Yeah. I understand why people like it.
Right, and not look. This show will not be for everybody who likes that show, because if you're just there to cry a lot, you know what right. I mean? Like maybe this isn't for you. It might have too many rough edges, but.
Well, but I'll tell you what, man, if you're a crier, there's plenty of tears here.
Yeah. Those moments are available, and it's so well done. I wish more people knew about it, and I wish it was more in conversations for like great things on TV. 'Cause the level of consistency, is very, very high right now. And the level of quality week to week is as well. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what the rest of it has in store. Because that's the other thing, is the show is really, and this is definitely not to me a hallmark of This Is Us. I say this like I've watched a ton of This Is Us. I haven't. But the show goes in a lot of like really unpredictable places at times. You know what I mean? It's a show that, you know, can end a season with a beautiful moving dance number. You know what I mean? Like out of nowhere, and yet it somehow makes sense. And it's occasionally funny, occasionally dramatic, and occasionally tense. And it's just, I don't know. Like, it's just it more television should be like this.
Right. No, that's exactly right. More television should be like this is the easiest way to put it.
Yeah. Kudos to FX, man.
They do a great job.
Still
we already know how I feel.
Good stuff out under the radar.
Yeah.
All right. Do you want to talk about Paddleton?
I do. Very much so.
I'm curious where you stood on this one.
I bet you are. I'm curious where I stood on this one. And I'm sure you can understand why, knowing my various stances on things. Like, it is pretty bad time, me, I guess. I would say, though, it's also pretty...
I thought you were going to say you're anti-made-up sports.
No. Love made-up sports.
Okay.
Huge, huge proponent, in fact, of made-up sports. So that is not
a problem. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, nothing is more wonderful to me than when I discover a sport in the real world that exists that I had not been aware of, and it feels like a made-up sport.
Gotcha,
you know what I mean?
Gotcha. All right.
However,
Paddleton didn't seem all that fun, though, I gotta say. as a game. As a game, just as a
if
game.
I have a complaint about the movie's plot, other than that it was quite sad, it's the fact that we never really got a great explanation of how Paddleton works.
Right. You hit a ball on the wall, then you try to bounce it in the trash can, I think, is pretty much the whole game.
Yeah, but is there defense? Like, at certain points, it seemed like they were sort of on the same team. Like, I can't.
Yeah,
I never got a clear picture.
I didn't understand why there was a halftime either.
Oh, I mean, I understand why there's a halftime. I mean, do you understand why there's like a little hut with hot dogs in a bathroom at the 10th tee at a golf course?
you just people need a break is just what you're saying, and they need snacks.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah, some snacks, maybe a beer or two, you know, whatever you need to rejuvenate yourself for.
Just make sure you have
further
cashews.
Activity.
You know, you don't want to be sitting there with just a whole bag of walnuts.
No. No. That's grim. As much of this movie was, to bring us slightly back around.
Sorry.
It was very sad. So I guess that would be the first thing I would warn a person who was considering watching it. The second thing I would
say
is that...
Were you expecting something other than sad?
No, but I may not... It's not that I wasn't expecting it. It's that it was a pretty persistently sad movie.
Yeah, okay. For me, that was sort of baked into the whole thing.
Okay, yeah, I get that. But also... Yes, I expected it to be, you know, on the sad side at times, as it was, and it's not that it wasn't what I expected, I'm just saying.
Yeah, I also didn't find it to be like, I mean,
well,
you know.
This is where I'm headed, I think.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Which is, while very sad in a somewhat persistent fashion, it also contained a lot of the elements that I think you love about Mark Duplass movies, a genuine look at real seeming people and some really clever and funny dialogue. And like, I don't know, I guess I'm here for all that. And overall, I thought it was a well-constructed movie. So maybe I should just shut up and not complain that it was pretty sad, because I did enjoy it, and it's not like it was 2 hours long and there was nothing, there were no smiles in it or no relief, but it was quite sad, but also I think pretty enjoyable. So like, I'm going thumb, at least one thumb up here.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's, you know, to me it was very, very typical Duplass, and I think the message is a lot really about like life is the stuff you say to each other while you're playing Paddleton, or while you're you know, taking that 6 hour car ride somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
the way you pass the time is the whole trip, really. You know what I mean?
And it counts on two guys being able to carry that conversation in a way that makes you feel like it's the kind and level of conversation that like justifies like a worldview built around it, right? And I think they did that. They do a really good job.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to me. You know, I sort of wonder what the movie of the next 2 years of Ray Romano's life would be like. You know what I mean? Like trying to figure out how to be in the world when you're like, you're a loner and you basically lost your one lifeline to polite society.
Right. But at the same time, it does have a sort of tinge of hope, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the movie ends with some ambiguity about what that would be like. Which is why
ambiguity,
sort of more,
at least, sure.
Yeah. Which is why I think it would be maybe interesting to see that. You know, but yeah, look, this is not my favorite Duplass movie, but it was enjoyable, and I think Romano and Duplass were excellent. And you know, if you like that kind of movie that, you know, maybe really has 6-8 people in it, ultimately.
I mean, really two, right? I mean, like it.
Yeah, I mean total. at all. Like, you know, that's, you know, really just a focused conversation between a couple of friends. Then yeah, it's definitely not a bad way to spend a Saturday. And while it, like I said, it is, you know, it's sort of a dark subject matter. This is not, I don't think it's a movie that you would be sad about. Like, if you watch it on Saturday afternoon, it's not going to mess up your night out later on. You know what I mean?
Right. That's kind of what I was saying, I think. It is very sad, but, like, you know, there's some hope to it and some, like, celebration of life aspect of it that makes you feel okay at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't know, like, I mean, if you bring up Paddington to me in 6 months, I don't.
Right. I don't know how much it sticks either. Yeah. It has that very, like, cute indie feel where, it was good and enjoyable and well acted and well written and marginally forgettable.
Yeah. Can I just say something, though? It's like, you know, we sort of got into this in our Oscar conversation that I think we had on the pod. I don't remember if it was an off pod or on pod conversation. But, you know, like, there's this real, you know, the idea that there's a real resistance in the Academy to Netflix as a concept because Netflix is ruining theaters or et cetera, et cetera. I'm paraphrasing, but the why isn't all that important. Just that there is some residual bitterness. I think we can all sort of agree. Right. And it's like, this is exactly the kind of movie that it's great that Netflix exists for, because I don't know
who's making it.
I don't know how it gets made. If it gets made, I don't know where it would be shown or how many theaters you could see it in. And the fact that, you know, this thing can be on Netflix and actually maybe potentially find an audience.
Good.
Isn't that good? You know what I mean?
Obviously, we agree on that.
You know, you and I were talking about doing, you know, potentially movies for homework, right? And it's like, you know, since I'm not particularly interested in superhero movies.
Yeah, that takes us out of the running for, like, at least half of the major releases.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, stuff people are actually talking about, right?
Yeah, like, we wind up not going to the movies for 6 weeks because I don't feel like seeing a comic book movie. So, right. Like, I'm, like, shouldn't we be thankful that a space exists in which we can still, you know, tell adult stories? And, you know, I'm not saying Netflix is the only one of those spaces. We're going to talk about this, an HBO movie that does a lot of the same stuff in a second, but... I think it's a good thing because I don't know that there are too many people beyond these couple of streaming companies. And, you know, I guess Apple's going to jump in the mix at some point on this as well, but that have the money to make these movies and make them at a high level with decent production values, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's a short list and almost all of it is an internet streamer. You know that there's the occasional, like, sort of lesser imprint on bigger production houses that will make smaller movies, and occasionally a passionate artist funds their own stuff. But for the very most part, it's streaming. It's Netflix, Hulu, HBO. Premium channels and streaming services make this kind of movie. And yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I want this kind of movie. Even if it is going to end up being a little bit forgettable more often than not, okay.
Yeah.
I want this to exist.
Right, exactly. And I'm not saying that this is a great example of the form and, like, thank God we have the opportunity to see Paddleton's, but, like... I do think that I'm glad that people have a chance to try to make a Paddleton, you know?
Yeah.
And we talk about, like, the, you know, the 70s as this, like, golden age of film, and so many of the kinds of movies that I feel like were made in the 70s, there's no place for them now in the modern commercial, you know, setup.
Right. And it doesn't seem like there's any reason that should be the case, really.
Yeah. I agree. Other than, you know, quadrant marketing.
Well, other than very cynical
and foreign box office and all of the other stuff that goes into the, you know, the business of putting out movies.
Right. But again, I mean, like, that's based on very cynical decision making, you know? Like, we...
Is it cynical? Is it cynical if you're in that business? I don't know.
Well, cynical in terms of, like, all we care about is the money. It's an artistic medium at the end of the day, right? And it'd be great if... Like, there did used to be a thing in the world and America about, like, valuing art and history. And I know we've moved significantly away from that, but, like, it is okay for a especially a company that makes so much money in other ways to do a thing that might make less money or even very little money to preserve the art form. Like, that's not so crazy. It happens.
I mean, I don't, like, I haven't studios, like, movie studios pretty much always been about commerce dating back to, like, the 50s and 60s. They're,
yes,
know,
to some degree,
they created
but
the star system and all that stuff. Probably earlier than that. Honestly, probably the 30s and 40s.
Yes, but I'm just saying, yeah, that obviously that's true to some degree, but they also have historically had art house releases, you know, and historically have released smaller movies with smaller profit margins.
Yeah, look, I think that's the difference. Is that the you know, when we were younger, right, there was this whole, like, sort of independent Sundance thing that was viable commerce, you know? And obviously, look, Sundance still exists and people are making independent movies. But the commerce part of that, the viable commerce part of that, I think is broken down a little bit. And that's the difference. I think that sort of changes what kinds of things we see.
Yeah, but I'm not sure the viable commerce has broken down. I think it may have changed. But aren't we essentially saying that it is viable via Netflix?
I mean, right. Well, yes, Netflix has made it viable. That's changed the economy. But I don't know if it's a viable theater thing anymore. I don't know. I would assume that if it was viable, someone would be doing it.
Well... But I think you know as well as I do that on its face, that's a faulty theory because people in business do dumb stuff all the time. So from my perspective,
yeah, but don't you think people if there's a possibility of a buck being made, like somebody tends to step into that void to try to take it?
Yes, generally intends to. Yeah. And I also think in certain businesses, and sometimes not for any reason related to that business particularly, there are opportunities left on the table for long periods of time because people are attached to a certain way of doing business or become attached to a certain idea about how the world works. For instance, everything we do has to sell internationally. I think there's probably still a way to make money in the theaters on a relatively inexpensive indie type movie because I think you can get enough people to see it if it's good.
Well, but isn't everything having to sell internationally? Doesn't that come down to the way that movies are financed? Right, they're financed internationally, which is why they have to be sold internationally.
Well, somewhat, but they don't. They shouldn't. If they have to be financed internationally, it's because people locally aren't putting money into them. What I'm saying is I do think a $5 million movie can make money in the theaters based on how many people I think are interested in this kind of movie if it's good.
Yeah.
But the risk proposition is definitely higher.
To be Blumhouse, doesn't it? You know what I mean?
They do it in horror. But,
right, yeah.
But, like, I do think you can make money that way. The issue is the risk proposition is higher because if it's not good, then it's possible nobody sees it. And with the big budget movies, the overwhelming reality is it has to be such a heap of trash not to be seen that it's a pretty low risk.
Yeah.
Because pretty mediocre to bad big budget action stuff get seen by millions and millions of people around the world.
Congratulations, Liam Neeson. You just made a heap of trash.
That's mean.
Yeah. Well, you know, reality is reality.
All right, he doesn't seem like the best guy, so I don't feel too bad for him.
Let's talk about OG, which is the Jeffrey Wright starring HBO movie about a guy who's been in prison for a couple decades on a murder robbery, and who had the run of his place for a long time, but is close to the end of his sentence. And trying to negotiate survival within the prison while still ensuring that he can still go home when it's time to go home. And, you know, to me, you know, this thing is all about Jeffrey Wright. And Jeffrey Wright's real good at acting. And... And that makes it watchable. I don't know if this is a great movie, but it's an interesting movie headlined by a really great performance.
I think interesting is the perfect word, right? I don't know if you felt the same as me about this, but in my mind, like you said, Jeffrey Rush is excellent.
Right. Jeffrey Rush, sorry. Jeffrey Rush, you know, is a different dude.
Right, Diane, that's enough.
Yeah.
So you've got that going for you. And then for me, the other stuff, maybe what it has to say about prisons and potential prison reform. Did you realize that many, if not most, of the other actors are actual inmates?
Yeah, I was vaguely aware of that they use real prisoners.
And I did think the co-star in particular was quite good.
Yeah, but I didn't think about it a lot as it was happening, which I think was a credit to both the acting performances of these non-actors, and I think also the vibe of realness that it kind of added to a lot of the like conversations, like in the body shop or on the basketball court. Like they felt lived in and real. And I'm assuming that most of that was all scripted.
I'm also assuming that, but I was going to say the same thing. Authentic was the word I was going to use. Very, very real, which I do think is somewhat of an achievement in the circumstances. And, you know, like I was saying, I think interesting is just the right word, because other than – you know, some really good acting performances, and in particular Jeffrey Wright, it was more it felt very clinical in its study of inmate behavior and prison culture, didn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it felt very studied is a good word. I felt like, I mean, I think they shot in a real prison, if I'm remembering that correctly.
They did, yeah.
And it felt like they had really taken the care to sort of try to recreate what that experience was like.
Yes,
I was interested in you know, because Jeffrey Wright is not a real physically imposing guy, you know what I mean? And look, I'm sure there are plenty of people in prison who aren't, you know what I mean? But it was interesting to me for him to work in these sort of layers of toughness in this character. And you could really see that he kind of like changed the way he walked and the way he moved, you know, and there was a lot of that sort of work that I thought was really smart and interesting. And I think in general, the movie had a good feel for the detail of prison life, like what it was like to be in the weight room and what it's like to sort of be in your room, much in the same way that Escape from Dannemora did. Although I think this movie was less fixated on those details. Escape from Dannemora was, you know, in a lot of ways about the everyday blandness of prison life.
Right. I do think that it was the same stuff, but in this movie it was almost viewed through the prism of how to survive as opposed to how to escape, which made the conception of the day-to-day very different, if that makes sense. So the like monotony of day-to-day life in Escape at Dannemora was in part like, we got to get out of this place.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And in this, it was like, I got to get through these last few days.
So I can get out of this place.
And it was more about navigating the life than like, this is so bad, we got to get out.
Yes, correct. Look, the situation was a little bit different. And, I think Jeffrey Wright's character understood that, like, if I don't, I can't just, you know, I mean, I can't just wait this out. Like,
right.
Action needs to be taken or I'm not getting out, you know. So either I'll get stuck here or I'll be, injured or killed. So,
right.
Yeah. So in that sense, it was different. What'd you think of the scene in where he's participating in this program that's about addressing the victims of your crimes? I forget the name they used.
Yeah, I didn't look too deeply into that part. I assume that's real. And again, I found it like not unlike it would have been watching a documentary of the same. Or reading a firsthand account of it. It felt very real and intense, but still more clinical than specifically emotional.
Yeah. It's
I almost think, though, that was deliberate from the filmmakers, was that this whole experience, it's not that there's no emotion. The characters portray emotion very well, but it does. The camera feels like it's at a remove, as if it's almost a documentary, as opposed to sort of deep in it, like you'd be in a normal narrative film.
Yeah, it's weird that I feel like that scene, in some ways, feels tacked on, and in other ways, feels completely essential. Like it's hard for me to imagine a movie without it.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. It's in some ways it's essential character development, in other ways it's character development that you really do get in other ways, you know, like it's not, you don't doubt that he's changed since he entered the prison. Right. And yet seeing him confront this is kind of a critical part of that. I mean, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah. I mean, and look at it. I think the idea that if you, you do something, terrible like that you can grow and change and improve as a human being, as a man, and still not be able to outrun it. Like that's probably a pretty real thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think an important part of the message here.
Yeah. Anyway, it's an interesting film, certainly. It took me a while to really want to get to it. And, I don't know why.
I know why. But I do think it's worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, Jeffrey Wright's the man.
He's, like you said, I mean, he does all the things that we praise our greatest actors for doing. His physicality changes as he embodies a role. His voice changes. He becomes characters in an incredibly deep feeling way. And I think, you know, in just as incredibly often as people like Daniel Day-Lewis or Meryl Streep, who we talk about all the time, Jeffrey Wright is one of the underappreciated greats, I would say.
Now we just got to get him off of Westworld.
Why isn't Westworld good?
I know. Westworld should be good. Television is a writer's medium, and I think that's your answer right there, to be honest.
Yeah, I guess it is, but it's vexing is what it is.
Yeah, because that show should be good, and it is.
It has all the pieces trying. In place, truly.
It's trying. Something sort of struck me, and this is going to be a random segue into Gary Clark Jr., but it struck me when they were in the auto body shop, like the music that they were listening to on the radio. This like blues, sort of number that they're listening to in the shop. I was sitting there thinking, like, what radio station is playing this? Like, I know they're in Indiana or whatever, but like, what radio station is playing this? And how have not all the young 20 something brothers in the shop just completely revolted at some point? Which brings me, and maybe that's it brings me into Gary Clark Jr., whose new record I think is really good. But the question hangs over to me of like, where is the audience for what this guy does? And I know that Gary Clark Jr. is quite popular and sells a lot of tickets and is really talented. I'm not saying, you know, just played Saturday Night Live. I'm not saying he doesn't have an audience. But like, there's just not a lot of people making this music or listening to this music anymore. You know what I mean? That's
except
one of the things that hangs over
this
to me.
Music. Because this is exactly what I think stands out about this album.
Blues
I
rock.
Wrote down
blues rock. That's what I'll say.
What'd you call it?
Blues rock. Blues heavy rock and roll.
I wrote down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 different styles of music that I feel like get played across 17 tracks. Now, I'll admit some of them outright have blues in the description, and others are distinctly blues rock, or at least Gary Clark versions of whatever I wrote down. But I do think this is a wildly eclectic album, and that's one of the things that I found so awesome about it.
I don't want to sell it short. Like, I'm not saying he made a fabulous Thunderbirds record. You know what I mean? Like,
right?
Like, there's definitely more going on here than that. But you know, you're not getting away from the
guitar. The word you're looking for is guitar.
And that's kind of like his kind of whiskey-soaked voice, too. You know what I mean? Like, it's not just the guitar.
I don't know. I mean, he uses that whiskey-soaked voice in different ways. There's a couple tracks that are almost like sound like Kanye. Like, there's some half-rapping stuff going on. There's some songs that are falsetto-y that sound sort of Prince-y. There's some song. There's like a reggae jam or two.
Yeah, there's definitely some reggae. Look,
there's a Ramones song. There's a Ramones punk song on here. There's a Curtis Mayfield track, you know. And then there's more of like there's a handful that are really sound very Gary Clark-y if you've listened to his stuff. There's a couple of real bare bones old school blues tracks. There's a couple of like maybe one Leon Bridges-y sort of Motown-y blues track, right. But just like. The ground covered here, I think, is pretty remarkable. And although you're right, there's no getting away from the guitar fundamentally. It is a guitar album, not unlike somebody like Prince. I think he's showing you all the awesome different things that can be done with a really great guitar player.
Yeah. And look, maybe I came at this, you know, from the wrong entry point because I don't want to belittle this. I think it's a very good record, and I think he's a damn genius. You know what I mean? Like, he's one of the greats out there right now.
There's just not so many people who could do something this even if there's certain distinctiveness to it. That might even make it more impressive because it's not copycat, but it is sort of genre bouncing and pigeonhole rejecting, if you will.
Yeah, that's fair. Do you think it's going to make him more popular? That I'm not sure. Right?
No, I don't.
No. I mean, you know, Saturday Live is a great get, you know. John Varvatos ad campaigns are good, man, and you get some really sweet free clothes. But
yeah, here's the thing I will say. In today's world, all it takes to for this album to make him bigger is one or two songs to break.
Yeah.
And if that happens for whatever reason, because I don't know why things break these days, but there's a lot of options here for people of different tastes. So if one of them happens to hit the right note, you never know. But as an album, I think it is probably a little on the eclectic side for most people. It is right up my alley, though.
Yeah. And look, you know, some of this is me and you know, being the
program director salt all over everything before we even get into it.
I got to start thinking about, well, how do I market this? and it's, you know, that the answer to those questions are hard. Those questions are hard, and they sort of just jump out at me when I listen to this thing that I'm already enjoying. You know what I mean? So
yeah, but it's hard for most good stuff, isn't it?
No, it's not, actually. Some things fit really easy in the marketing things.
I knew you'd take
offense
at that.
And some things don't. And look, sometimes the things that sort of fall between the cracks and you don't know where to put them wind up being the most popular things, you know? Because then they wind up fitting in, they sort of go from fitting in no places to lots of places.
Do you have an example in mind?
I'm not, well, to me, like this is the sort of, it's a very old example. But like, you know, like Dave Matthews or like Norah Jones when like those records broke, you know what I mean? You don't really
know
where to,
like under the table.
Yeah. Dave Matthews. Talking about when Dave Matthews like first broke, there was like nothing that really sounded like that. And so it allowed it to be able to wind up in lots of places. And Norah Jones, I think, is sort of the same kind of thing, right? Where it's like everybody felt like it didn't really belong to anybody. So in a lot of ways, it belonged to everybody.
This sultry jazz vocalist on pop radio.
You could even say Adele was like that, like sort of a game changing thing for pop radio.
Maybe, but she was more of a throwback than a you know, groundbreaker. Yeah,
there's a little bit more of an obvious place, but I don't know if there was an obvious fit, if that makes sense. You know what
I
mean?
What I don't think there was an obvious place remaining in the pop world for what she was doing.
Yeah.
Like who's the last, I guess Amy Winehouse kind of, but other than Amy Winehouse, you got to go back to like Barbara Streisand for like a diva who was really that popular.
Yeah. Yeah. And she certainly carved out her own place now. She could just plop in and drop an Adele sounding record whenever she wants. And
exactly. Yeah. And you know, it's different from the like pop females that we saw in the 90s and 2000s, like a Mariah Carey or a Christina Aguilera or Britney or whatever, because they were really pop creations, not diva vocalists.
Right. And
even if that's part of Christina Aguilera's makeup, like she was still a production.
Oh yeah, she was found and scouted and marketed and all of that sort of hangs over all of it. Sometimes, you know, sometimes you get people who start like that and then, you know, break out onto their own and create something else. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the cool things about Gary Clark, to spin it back a little bit, is a better analog is probably like the Black Keys. But you got a guy who comes up as just like, he's really good at this blues guitar thing. Like he's a sort of a virtuoso and he can knock this thing out of the park. And he expands his take on blues rock over a couple albums. And then again, not unlike the Black Keys, delivers something eclectic and different. And this, we may look back and say, like, had he made another Bright Lights, Big City at this point, he could have skyrocketed to another tier of fame. But I much prefer to have this interesting album.
Yeah. Hey, interesting albums are good. I'm pro interesting albums.
Yeah, and I think in the long run, this is more likely to stand up than yet another album of Gary Clark's blues rock.
Right. And look, you know, for all the experimenting, it never feels untrue to him, I don't think.
No, and actually, did you happen to hear any of the press around this?
I have not seen a ton of press around it, no, other than the label marketing Marin stuff, you know.
Yeah, he did Marin, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I also didn't really see any press, but that's an incredibly in-depth interview, and they talked about his sort of take on the genre and this album in particular. And in many ways, like this, he described this as more of a representation of him than the other albums, just because it includes more. And if you, like, when I look down my list of different styles played, most of them are one or two songs, maybe three, go into a category, and then the like R&B blues rock that is his staple is four or five. So that makes sense. That's still predominantly his thing, but he's showing you all this different stuff that's part of who he is as an artist, and I think that's really cool.
Yeah, it's a good record. You know, it's definitely worth your time.
And I think, you know, we talked during the week about also discussing the Weezer record. And I think, I don't know, did we decide if we're going to do that next week? I don't think we are, but
I think we pass on it. Yeah.
But I think that's, that is reflective, but also the one thing it would have been good as is a comparison point here, because in Weezer's case, they're doing only a slightly different, and in fact, probably more poppy and less interesting version of the same sort of churned out feeling Weezer stuff that's been happening since the Green album, really. the last thing that felt really new for Weezer was the Green Album, and it may have felt new because of the long layoff as much as the music. So I'd much rather have a Gary Clark, even if it costs him a couple of record sales. I'd much rather have this than more of the same.
Yeah, well, who's voting for more of the same? Right?
Well, well, maybe that's not that you wanted a short podcast, so let's not go down that road.
All right, let's talk about what we are going to talk about next week, since we know we're not going to talk about Weezer. we had a couple check-ins in mind. You all right there?
Excuse me. I tried to slip in a snack and inhaled crumb.
Yeah, it didn't slip in so good.
Nope.
we're going to check in on You're the Worst, which is in its final season and I guess headed toward an ultimate conclusion. The Shop is back. And so a couple episodes of that. We'll check in on that as well. And then you suggested Losers on Netflix?
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in this as a sports dude. It seems like we got maybe Jean Vandeveld in there. Like some of the most famous losers in sports sort of mini-docs about their famous losses. So see how people take sports tragedy.
I'm a fan of mini docs, so
yeah, it should be fun.
In addition to sports, we are also, or at least I'm going to suggest the case against Adnan Syed. Now I'm a little nervous about this because I know that you are not the biggest fan of true crime.
It's not even that's not true necessarily. I know less about Serial than I think anybody in the world, because I not only didn't listen, I just have almost no concept of what it is. The name vaguely rings a bell, but if you hadn't connected the two, I probably would not have. So, but my understanding is this is more of a summary of Serial than a summary and extension of the story than it is a pure extension.
Yes, yeah, summary extension, I think, is the way that at least that I'm seeing that it will be.
Yeah, but I mean, as long as I'm not going to be totally lost, I'm down.
I also think that I think the fact that you know next to nothing about it, you're one of the rare people probably on Earth at this point, it feels like, who knows next to nothing about this case, and that I've, you know, listened to the whole podcast and done some.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting
that
test case.
Yeah, like I think it'll be interesting to see from the perspectives, from those two varying perspectives, how it'll be different. So that's a three-parter, I guess, on HBO.
We're trying to get through the whole deal?
And I don't know if we're trying to get through the whole deal or not, but we're definitely going to at least watch part one.
Okay.
And I'm going to watch part two and three pretty much no matter what. So you and me will revisit that. But for you, for homework, watch at least part one of the case against Adnan Syed. And then last but not least is Working Moms on Netflix.
Yeah, I really don't know much about this either, other than that Netflix has been throwing it at me for a week or two now, so I'm interested to see what it's about.
Yeah, that's literally all I know. All I know is that it's gotten some real good placement on my home screen. And
I do think it is supposed to be funny, and it is about working mothers.
Yeah, sometimes in life you just say, okay, fine, Netflix, you win.
Yeah, exactly.
I will hit play, and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it wasn't that hard of a sell, but we'll find out.
I suggest you tell a friend to do that on this podcast. Like, don't question it. We're throwing
exactly
at you. Just
hit
play.
The time, right? You're driving around. What else are you going to do? Listen to the toy department.
That's right. And leave us a review or something.
Only if it's good.
I don't even care at this point. You can leave us a bad
really?
Review. Yeah.
All right. Fair enough. Review us however you see fit.
All right. Let's get out of here.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.